Hello and welcome to the 28th episode of Good Copy, Bad Copy. I'm Emily King, Vranex's Marketing Executive. This month is a highlights episode, as we look back at some of the best insight and advice on B2B copywriting and content marketing that we've had on the show over the past 12 months. So if you've ever wondered how you're meant to shape a story in a business-to-business context, or what intelligent content means for copywriters, we've got you covered. And this means this is a great episode to jump in on if you've not listened to us before. Back in episode 17, our founder, Fiona Campbell-House, talked with her partner, screenwriter James Henry of Green Wing, Smack the Pony, and Delivery Man fame, about applying storytelling to B2B content. How do you bring storytelling into B2B? Here's how.
The whole thing for me is, when people talk about in marketing, you've got to tell stories, there seems to be such a liberal interpretation of what you mean by a story that it becomes almost meaningless. So, for example, yesterday, there's a marketing automation software vendor called HubSpot, and yesterday they were having their 8th anniversary. So what they'd done to celebrate their 8th anniversary, to do a thing for social media, is that they'd got all of their people, I think, in Dublin into their foyer, and they'd all stood in a figure of 8 sign and had a photo taken and put it on Twitter. And then somebody had seen this and retweeted it and said, this is a brilliant example of visual storytelling from HubSpot. And it's literally a photo of all the people in their office saying it's our 8th birthday. It's not a story in the sense that it's not overcoming a monster.
Unless the villain is nuts. I don't know how, yeah.
You could infer that this is a rags-to-riches story because, you know, they've been around for 8 years and they're a successful company. But there's no real story behind that. But yet this is still given as an example of storytelling. So what I'm interested in is, how can we take some of the things that James has been talking about and apply them to the work that we do to make stories more compelling? And I did read recently a really interesting article about how the structure of classic storytelling relates to the structure of marketing content by a guy, I think he's called Andrew Hutchinson, based in Australia, I think. And he was saying that in marketing, you've got a very, very short space of time to get your story over. You haven't got the luxury of a 2-hour, 3-hour film or, you know, 500 page novel or anything like that. So he's saying what marketers should do is look at those films, look at really successful films, look at the structure of the story, look at the moments of really heightened emotional intensity in those stories, and take those moments and use those. It's like a sort of greatest hits reel, I guess. It's like, take those moments and use those in your marketing, and use those moments to then hang the story off. So people recognise those moments, they understand that those moments are heightened moments of intensity, it draws them in straight away, and then you hang the story almost off the back of them. It's almost doing things backwards. And I find that really interesting. And then I was looking back over some of the videos that we'd previously looked at, B2B marketing videos, you know, do they work as stories or don't they work as stories? And I found the one, again, which is an Intel video about one of the winners of their, they have a sort of Young Innovators Award, and they had this 15-year-old boy who had sort of made a breakthrough in research for a cure for pancreatic cancer. And he'd won their award for that year. And they start this video with the really most intense emotional moment of this guy's entire story, I guess, which is when he's coming up to the stage. They're just about to announce the winner. They announce it's him. He comes up to the stage to receive his award, and you can see on his face the emotion, intensity that he's feeling. They start with that, and then they sort of rewind and go back and tell his story about how he's made this breakthrough and how he's done it in his science class at school. So that's something that I found really interesting, a way of taking what you'd expect from a classic story, applying it to a kind of marketing context. But I know there are lots of other ways that marketers can tell stories that might not actually be considered stories in the classic storytelling sense. And I think when a lot of people say, oh, marketers need to tell stories, or oh, salespeople need to tell stories in order to close deals, what they mean is they need to be telling anecdotes. So it's not, you know, three-act structure stories. Yeah. It's just basic anecdotes of, here's somebody that was in a similar situation to you, and here's what they did, and here's how it turned out for them.
Well, as soon as you're talking about anecdotes, you're into stories, and amazingly, you are into three-act structure, I think, which is quite interesting. You're incredibly sort of simple point of view, but saying, here's a character, you can fracture it, you can start at the end, you can say, here's a very successful person, how did they become this successful? And then find out more about it, or you could start with someone kind of poised on the precipice, it could go either way. Then you go back and get and see how he got there. So yeah, although I'm talking about big thing, big mythic kind of stories, you can tell these stories in a minute and a half, or a minute, or three frames, or infographics. They're all equally relevant. But if you understand the basics of kind of setup, escalating confrontation, and then resolution, you've kind of got just a little tiny toolkit. You know how to pull things apart that aren't working. You understand how to convey ideas that have some emotional resonance.
I wondered if comics are for B2B. For episode 19, Fiona and I discussed how you could use comic strips and books in B2B marketing as standalone content or to complement campaigns on blogs and more. And most importantly, we explained how to write comics.
You know, if there were four or five things that marketers should bear in mind if they're just starting out with comics, what do you think they need to think about?
Well, they really need to decide whether the format is right for them. I love comics, but I don't think that everyone necessarily wants to be making them. You might find that actually what you want to get across is, perhaps if it's you want to go visual, but you might find there's another visual format that's better. So you need to decide whether or not you really would be better with an infographic or a video. And if you're not, and you decide that yes, a comic is the way to go, then yeah, sure, decide on that format.
And I think, you know, that there's lots of different scenarios or stories that comic formats are good for, but I think for some of them you would have to have quite a lot of existing technical skill with writing for a comic book. I mean, just thinking about that Google one that we were talking about just now, which was a, I don't know, something like 18 page web comic on how, I think it was Chrome,
yeah,
how
the Chrome browser works. Yeah.
Which was a really good way of making quite a technical topic accessible and digestible. But you would, I think, to be able to write something like that, you would really have to have an appreciation of how comics work and how, and you'd have to have a really, I mean, for writers, it's often difficult to think visually. I mean, we're used to just thinking about what words we want to express the point. If you're writing for a comic format, you have to also think about what images and visuals are going to express the point. So I think, you know, coming up with an 18-page webcomic about to explain a technical topic is not the kind of place you'd want to jump in and start as a B2B marketer. I think you'd want to start somewhere a little bit more simple and, you know, maybe just with a single frame bit of topical industry humour, and then kind of move on from there. I mean, we look in our ebook that we've done about the kind of stories that are good for comic format. So we were talking about, you know, you could do a case study like that, and we have written those ourselves at Radix for clients, or you could kind of explore an industry issue by showing characters in the situation that's affected by the industry issue. But I think, I don't know if you'd agree, that the kind of best place to start is maybe your sort of 1-3 frame humorous comic strip looking at something that's happening in your industry.
I think as long as the story you're telling is genuine, then yeah, the starting off for the sort of short form end of things would probably be best until you're comfortable with, like, it's like writing short stories or writing tweets. The shorter formats really constrain you, make you really think about how to make the best use of the space available to you, so you can quickly appreciate how getting a panel to show something with the artwork in it rather than having a character spiel off a whole load of stuff would actually be the better way to go.
Mm-hmm. And as a writer, like Twitter, it's a really good exercise in discipline. I've written quite a few comic strips that you do have to get that story across, and you do have to get the dialogue really down to the absolute bare minimum. I think it's a nice challenge. It's a nice kind of project to work on. So, I mean, for those that are just starting out, again, how would you actually put that script together?
It's really hard to find examples of comic scripts out there, and when you do, they're quite varied in format. But just maybe look at the kind of script layout that films kind of follow, where you have, you know, like the scenes described, and then you have the dialogue, basically. So you would kind of be like, oh, this, so you would say what panel number it is, and obviously be thinking in your head it's going to be read from left to right, you know, so you'd describe the scene, say what the characters are saying. If you want to use something like captions, which are those little boxes you sometimes see in comics, which kind of describe a bit of the background, what's happening, like in, you could have, you've got an office scene happening and it might say in blah blah's office in a little caption box, you'd sort of go basically in that order, because the artist needs their information first. What happens in speech bubbles and that is secondary, because that always gets added last, so you want the art first, then what's been said, and just kind of keep going in order by sort of redoing that for each panel.
Yeah, and I think one of the things I found difficult to begin with is that you can't have any kind of progression within a panel.
No,
it's like a static scene.
Yeah, it has to be as a still moment in time. You do get action comics where it looks like movement has happened, but for this kind of like writing, you would basically be kind of like saying, oh, you know, so-and-so is stood doing sort of a thing, or they're in a such-and-such a pose. You could say somebody's running, but you can't have them doing anything else in that panel. They can't run and then sit down in the same panel.
And I guess, you know, we're getting towards the end of the podcast, but yeah. I guess a final thing is, you know, if you're a B2B marketer and you've decided to create a comic strip, and that's great, and you've come up with a great story and something that's really funny, and you've drawn it yourself, or you've got somebody else to draw it for you, how do you then get it out there into the world and actually get people to see it?
Again, I'd say, you know, think about your website first, think social media. We've had a little bit of success with hosting what comic strips we've done on Instagram and having it cross-post onto Twitter, and we do actually get quite a bit of engagement from those posts, which is nice. So you might want to consider doing that. In fact, really short scripts. I mean, forget Instagram, you know, Twitter or LinkedIn, you can just put them on there. It's an image, and those... Well, Twitter interactions, it's been shown that, you know, if you post as an image in it, it's a high amount of interaction compared to other posts. And obviously LinkedIn starved for images.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And we've also, you know, we incorporate ours in our email newsletter as well, don't we? So that's another good way to get it out there. And, you know, what you were saying about images on Twitter, getting a better engagement rate, as the same goes for blogs as well, doesn't it? So if you've got a comic strip as part of your blog, or a single frame comic as part of your blog, then that's a much better way to get attention and get engagement with your blog post.
For episode 20, Fiona invited copywriter and Lungfish managing director David Maguire onto the show to discuss how to use emotion in B2B copy. Part of this is realising how tone and voice interact with each other and who it is that you are writing for.
The other day I was at an event around database as a service, and there were a bunch of CIOs in a room basically talking about the same thing, and do you use the public cloud or the private cloud and this kind of thing. And the number of attitudes to what's the best solution, just among the people in the room and their personality types, and again, their attitude to risk was a huge thing. You know, so people, oh, I want to keep all my options open, and people, no, I want to lock it down and not think about it. You know, different things will appeal to different people. The interesting thing is, how much can you vary your message if it's something about who you are as a brand? It's very hard for a brand to appear groundbreaking and innovative, and also to appear reliable and proven.
Yes, yeah, and I think this is something that we've talked about before, actually, on one of these podcasts, is that's almost the difference between your voice and your tone. So, you know, you may have the same kind of brand image and who you are, and that's your voice, but you would use different tones depending on what kind of audience or who you're talking to. I was going to come on to say, is like, how, I mean, if we're moving towards triggering more emotional responses, how do we actually get that into the copy that we're writing? And, you know, one of the things that I try to do now is, when I'm writing something like an ebook or a slideshow or something like that, is to actually frame the kind of emotional or psychographic profile of the person I'm talking to. So this ebook is for innovators who want to develop something really new and groundbreaking and impress their boss and, you know, do something great for the world as well. And, you know, once you've profiled that person, this ebook is for you, then you can stop reading if you're not that kind of person. And if you are that kind of person, you're like, yeah, this is for me, you know, this is going to be really good. I'm going to read something great here, hopefully. So I think that's one way to start, you know, bringing that into the copy without departing from what the brand actually is all about. So, you know, you keep your kind of brand voice, but then you start being very specific about what kind of person you're talking to. I don't know if, I mean, do you have... Yeah, other tips and other ways that you bring more emotion or kind of stimulate more of an emotional response from your copy?
Some of it depends on the subject, but I think that, you know, it's whether you are going for a particular emotional response or whether it's just something where you're looking to invoke kind of a vague kind of nexus of emotions around a brand, you know, where, you know, someone just kind of, you just want them to appear trustworthy and large and, you know, or whatever, or, you know, and it's, and there are things like that that are, a lot of it's how you say things. rather than what you say a lot of the time, I think, you know, in that kind of positioning sort of sense. Yeah. So for that kind of thing, I mean, if you come back to, you know, the classic ones, it's not specifically a B2B ad, but, you know, but if you come back to the old Apple and Mac stuff, you know, the Apple versus Mac adverts, I mean, they're just classics. But because, you know, it's not a, you know, although that they're saying all of these rational things, the thing you take away is, no, I want to be the cool guy. I want to be him, and I don't want to be him. And, you know, and they're giving you all the stuff for your brain to rationalise that, going, yes, I'm going to spend thousands of pounds on a computer instead of hundreds of pounds on a computer because, ooh, viruses, or because, ooh, I can plug a camera into it and it will just work. But actually, you know, those are the justifications. You know, actually, again, it's you know, it's a system one, system two thing.
People will think I'm cool.
You really, the emotion is, I want to be him
because
I'm cool, or I want to be cool. And then, oh, look, and he's given me lots of reasons I can justify that to myself. And it's... so it's a lot of it's sometimes about how you say it rather than what you say. But then equally, I think it's got to be real. It's got to be some, you know, if you're looking for a specific emotional response to marketing, it's got to be something that, that people really care about. And you play on an emotion that they can genuinely be expected to feel. You know, depending on who they are and what their profile is, you're going to have a hard time making somebody feel joyful about their servers. You just are.
As part of episode 22, Fiona and I looked at ways you can keep content fresh, from looking to inspiration in print media to repurposing existing content into different formats and platforms. There's a lot you can do to help your B2B content stand out and remain relevant.
I mean, a couple of years ago, there was a really revolutionary piece in the New York Times called Snowfall, which we've talked about before, which is a real multimedia extravaganza of telling a story with different multimedia elements. And I think although that itself is maybe become a little bit cliched and tired, people are still taking kind of inspiration from that, looking at how to use different multimedia elements to tell a story.
I mean, they had done some follow-ups to that. I mean, it wasn't last year before last, the Tomato Can Blues piece was really good.
And I think it's, people talk about the kind of print media being in decline and, you know, they're not doing anything innovative. But I think if you look at some of the ways that print media has transitioned to online and to digital, they are leading the way in many cases in the kind of content that they're creating. So I think there's a lot of inspiration to be taken there. Your ebooks and your slideshows, but almost every piece of content that we would traditionally have created in B2B is like a linear narrative. And I think there are some quite interesting ways to chop them up and make them less linear and make them more kind of optional narratives in different directions. So that, especially with kind of mobile tablet platforms, online platforms, you don't necessarily have to start at page one and work your way through to page 10. You can do things digitally, so you can just find your own path through the content and pick and choose the bits that you want. And I was talking to our colleague Kieran yesterday about, I think it was a short story that he had been reading, which is actually presented as a deck of cards. So the first page and the last page are always the first page and the last page, but then you can sort of shuffle the interior of the story to kind of make your own narrative out of it. So I think there's quite a lot of interesting experimentation to be done with non-linear narratives, if you like. If that sounds a bit kind of too bold and experimental, I think there are kind of minor tweaks that you can also make to your old content to freshen it up and make it new. Case studies, for example, if you've got a written case study, or a set of written case studies, you could go back and revisit those. And one of our favourite topics, why not turn it into a set of comics, a comic or a set of comics? So basically comic book stories about how your customers have overcome problems or achieved goals, but told in a kind of visual illustrated format rather than a text-based format. Not very many people have really mastered the art of infographics yet, I don't think. But once you've mastered the art of infographics, it's great to go back and sort of look over your existing content. Is there anything here that we can tell in a kind of data visualization style way? Is there any kind of great data point we can pull out of here and illustrate it visually? So I think, you know, there's a lot that can be done to go back over existing content, try and repurpose it for new formats and make it fresh and new and
you know, use it at different stages in the funnel and use it for different, you know, platforms and devices as well.
Finally for this episode, I ended my interview with Velocity Partners creative director and co-founder Doug Kessler, which was originally in episode 24. Here we discuss the idea of intelligent content and what it can mean for B2B copywriters. Please be aware that this interview was recorded in a corner of a popular restaurant chain.
Intelligent content is being touted as the next big thing in content marketing. In your view, what's the difference between intelligent content and traditional content, Doug?
Okay, well, I'm still learning about intelligent content too, so it was new to me not very long ago where Joe Polizzi and Content Marketing Institute wrote about it and they bought an event called Intelligent Content. And when those guys get excited about something, I think it's worth a look. So for me, I've seen their definition. I think the Ann Rockley definition is structurally rich and semantically categorized content, which makes it automatically discoverable, reusable, reconfigurable, and adaptable. That seems to be the characteristics of intelligent content. So it sounds to me like content objects that can be hot swapped into new media, new channels, new pieces of content. That would be my definition of it.
Speaking as a copywriter, what kind of challenges do you think intelligent content will present for people writing it?
Yeah, I think intelligent content really will be a challenge for writers because we're used to, certainly I'm used to, linear writing and linear stories where you take someone on a journey, however short or long, and you hold them by the hand and you walk them through your story, you know, and it's almost like a three-act structure, you know. And what I'm understanding of intelligent content is that it will break up the three-act structure and you'll be peddling one scene at a time, for instance. These things will be swapped into new content by other people or even automatically for new channels. So if I were writing knowing that that was going to happen to my content, I would write very differently. I think it would probably be a lot more soundbitey and a lot less dependent on this three-act structure or narrative arc. And that scares me because that's what I feel like I'm good at, and I think it's what people like. It's what, you know, content that people want to read has some narrative arc to it. So I do think I'm a little bit skeptical about intelligent content. But I know that I'd have to write differently if I were writing for that kind of context.
For me, it makes me feel like I need to do a list of 5 nonlinear video games that writers need to play in order to understand snippets of content.
Yeah.
Top of that would be Skyrim.
Okay.
But, you know, that you wouldn't want to get too far down the rabbit hole with that.
Yeah.
Which new skills do you think copywriters will need to learn to thrive in intelligent content as it sort of develops?
Yeah, I think the new skills for writers will be about modularity, and I suppose writers will also be not just originating content objects and modules that get swapped around by other people, but they'll also be doing the swapping and recombining. So I suppose writers will probably have to get good at things like tagging and structuring really well and, you know, and recognizing where all these chunks of content are going to end up. And that feels like quite a learning curve to me. I don't think that's a natural skill for writers.
Do you think the software tools that writers use today are sufficient as content formats develop? Have you found any new writing apps that are more suited to the types of content we write for today?
As far as content writing apps, I'm kind of stuck back in Word. I still use Word. I know how it works. I probably use 5% of its functionality. I have tried some of these stripped-down writing tools where they get rid of all distractions and it's text only, and I guess I'm a creature of habit. I stick to what I know. I certainly use Evernote as a writing tool, and I can imagine in an intelligent content context and universe, things like Evernote where you can capture snippets and chapters and reassemble yourself will be increasingly useful. But for me, I'm kind of old-fashioned that way.
There's also perhaps an issue of with apps making sure that anyone who's reviewing it along the chain from outside the agency to clients are actually able to access it. Is that also an issue for collaboration?
Actually, I think that is a good point. I probably should have brought it up in that answer, which is, you know, collaborative tools certainly will make the new kind of content marketing already, even before intelligent content, tools that will let people come in and collaborate on the work, like Google Docs, Google Apps for Work, are obviously really useful and on the rise. Or there's the workflow apps like Kapost and things like that that do you know, the, all of the workflow and backend that let editors and writers collaborate around topics and issues and pieces, those certainly will get more and more and more important. I'm also a little bit old school about wanting to control the work, and sometimes I think version control can be lost, and you find something's gone live when 9 people have weighed in with their changes, and you didn't know about it. That scares me, but again, this is an old dog talking about new tricks.
Okay, for my last question, I'd like to ask you, how long do you think it will take for intelligent content to become the norm for marketing organizations?
I don't think intelligent content will become the norm at all. I think it will remain a niche until the day that our robot overlords win in marketing and replace humans, which I just did a post about this, which was half in jest, a marketer automation, you know, welcome to your robot overlords or something like that. And I was kidding when I started it a little bit, looking at the people at checkout counters in stores who are being replaced by the self-scanners and saying, wow, marketers are going this way, they're going to replace us. And I was half joking. I do mean it. But the more I read about it to write that post, the scarier it got. And I realized a lot of our jobs are going to be replaced. And you, so I could then imagine in that world that 90% of content is this kind of content. But it's hard for me to picture what a world that would be. And I'm hoping it's far enough after my death that I don't have to find out.
Thank you very much, Doug.
Sure.
Interview.
Sure. Appreciate it.
That's all we've got time for this episode of Good Copy, Bad Copy. You can follow Radix on Twitter at radix.com, and you'll find our website at radix-communications.com, where you can also sign up for a monthly e-newsletter for the latest copywriting tips and insights.